from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Here's former UN Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power in 2016 addressing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his allies on the humanitarian crisis in Aleppo.
Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit? Is there nothing you will not lie about or justify?
Powers writes about the diabolical atrocities in Syria and many other foreign policy challenges in her memoir, The Education of an Idealist. The book recounts her journey from war correspondent to human rights activist to the White House and what she has learned along the way. That's next after news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, to be sure, writes former UN ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, in her new memoir, The Education of an Idealist. But turning a blind eye to the toughest problems in the world is a guaranteed shortcut to the same destination. She first rose to prominence with her 2003 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, and she pushed for a human rights-driven foreign policy in the Obama administration. And she joins us this hour to discuss the effects of those policies, as well as her own journey into politics and her book. And welcome, Samantha Power. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
We actually talked about your book back when it first came out, which was a Pulitzer Prize-winning book. And I sort of follow a tradition when I have someone of your stature to talk about things that are very much in the news and that concerned you when you were with the United Nations and in the Obama administration. I'm talking now about Iran, of course, and I'd like to hear what your take is, because things do, unfortunately, seem to be more tense than they were. They seem to be escalating. The rhetoric is getting more and more harsh. John Bolton was replaced. In fact, do you know his replacement, Robert O'Brien?
Not personally, no, but I know his background, certainly.
And we'll come to that in a moment. He seems to be certainly closely allied with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. So there's not that much ideological, perhaps, dissonance as there was previously when we had the John Bolton there. But I'd like to know what you think can happen here. We're in a pretty volatile situation, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, it looks from Trump's tweets this morning, which is how one divines our foreign policy on a given day, but that he has pulled back for now from the threat of using military force and for now is going to respond to the attacks with a new tranche of economic sanctions against the Iranian government and a range of entities. And so,
I mean, how much can these sanctions be increased? I mean, pretty high bar now.
There is that question. And because the Trump administration rolled back, of course, the sanctions relief that had been put in place when Iran ended its nuclear program and when we succeeded internationally in cutting off the pathways to a nuclear weapon. But I think the larger worry is the Trump position on Iran, which is they call, I think, maximum pressure, doesn't have any articulated strategic objective. There's no – if you were Iran, whether you're the mullahs or you're Rouhani, the president, you wouldn't know what it would take to get well, as it were, with the United States. If – President Trump doesn't want war with Iran, doesn't want to take military action, as a number of officials have backgrounded reporters in saying he doesn't. He has a strange way of showing it, because blowing up the nuclear deal and driving really much of the rest of the world together with Iran, where the United States is the one that's isolated rather than Iran, the rule breaker and the destabilizer in the region, and potentially the source of these attacks. Trump is sort of closing off his decision space with his rhetoric, but also in leaving himself few options other than ratcheting up pressure, as you say. And Iran is not taking it lying down. They say, hey, all the international bodies were saying we were complying with the deal. We're in the right here. We have the support even of America's closest European allies, who back us in saying that we were compliant with the deal, who are trying to give us financial relief to offset the effect of Trump reimposing sanctions when we, Iran, were in compliance with the deal. And so, you know, just the pathways for Trump, since he doesn't have a stated objective, since there's no threshold that Iran can meet and know that they're going to get the relief that they were promised by the nuclear deal, he's sort of driving himself into a corner. And if he doesn't want war, he has a funny way of showing it, because the way to avoid war is to go back to the deal that was working. And the way to avoid war with a country pursuing a nuclear weapon is definitely to go back to that deal, because it was a stabilizing factor. It wasn't ending. It wasn't a panacea for Iran and its actions, its destructive actions. But it made for a safer and more stable world.
And you're right. I don't believe he has much leverage with Iran. He's talking about being locked and loaded. So that rhetoric, again, is very strong. But when it came to an action with a drone that came from Iran previously, he didn't act on it. He talked very strongly and brazenly, but he didn't act on it. And there's a feeling that Trump really doesn't want war. He's going to think Phil's probably going to hurt him politically. He said he was opposed to the Iraq war. That's up for grabs. But he's on record as having said this. And now we've got these drones that hit Saudi Arabia, probably coming from Iran, but it hasn't been incontrovertibly proven at this point. And yet Trump has said it has been proven to his satisfaction. So there aren't many options left here unless he wants to go and actually engage in military action.
I mean, what would be nice is if after a deep breath, people went back to the drawing board and said, okay, you know, what is the package deal that we can achieve with Iran? Are there negotiations that can be restarted? What would it take to satisfy? What is the threshold? What would it take to satisfy us, the Trump administration? But moreover, to take another lesson of what has happened over the last week, which is the war in Yemen needs to be brought to an end. I mean, the gravest humanitarian catastrophe, with the possible exception of Syria, Syria's ongoing conflict, on the earth today. The U.S. complicit in backing the Saudis, no matter how many weddings, markets, funerals, Saudi targeteers hit in the course of that battle. And, you know, the attack this weekend, I think in large measure, grows out of that war and the escalating tensions in what is becoming increasingly a proxy war within Yemen.
It is indeed a proxy war. And one has to ask, let me go back a little bit historically with you, because you mentioned Syria and Yemen, and you write a great deal about Syria, particularly what you wanted as opposed to what President Obama wanted. And you wanted a no-fly zone, and you wanted action. You wanted intervention for humanitarian reasons. And here was President Obama talking about a red line, and a lot of people feel that that inability to act, or I know you say the Congress got in the way here too to a great extent, and I'll concede that, but a lot of people feel that that was one of the things that maybe allowed Donald Trump to win the presidency, because Hillary Clinton was pretty much following through on Obama diplomacy, or what she believed would be Obama characteristic actions in terms of running the country. And one could attribute that to a major mistake and also at least the appearance of a kind of cravenness and not following through on the Obama administration.
Well, first let me say, just in writing the book that I've just written, The Education of an Idealist, you know, I'm trying to bring readers into the Situation Room when one is confronted with something as horrifying as...
Which you do a good job of, by the way.
Well, thank you. but I mention that just because, you know, again, hindsight is 20/20, and I can tell you now, and we can each draw dotted lines from various events in the Obama presidency and ask ourselves, in part because we're all doing it every day, you know, what could we have done differently to avoid what we're going through now with the current leadership? But what I try to show is just, you know, on the one hand, you have this sort of imperative of responding to the largest chemical weapons attack in 25 years. This is back in 2013. And, you know, chemical weapons not only in the hands of the Assad regime, but potentially falling into the hands of ISIS, who would grow and expand, you know, over the course of the coming months and years. I mean, that was a very destructive scenario that we were very worried about. On the other hand, as you noted, in the context of Trump and the Iran-Saudi tensions, we had in 2013, just as we do even more so today, a war-weary public, not a lot of political support for even the very, very limited military action that was contemplated in response to the chemical weapons. I think where I come down at the end of it is you need to have a thicker base of domestic support. It is an outrage even to this day that our military is out in so many theaters in the world fighting. Whether they should be fighting in the different theaters is another conversation. We're way too militarized in our foreign policy right now. But fighting without any domestic authorization other than the post 9/11 authorization that went through Congress, and that's a flimsy sort of backdrop and ballast for men and women to have. So what I try to show is the domestic and the foreign kind of intertwined. But where I also land is the one thing we do know is that when you say that you're going to go and do something and then you don't, there are costs to that. And in the wake of the 2013 red line chapter, we did unwittingly, and certainly this wasn't Obama's intention, but we did telegraph to the Syrian government, to President Putin in Russia, and to much of the world, the constraints on the commander-in-chief, the sort of exhaustion that America does feel. And it was an accurate projection, I think, of public will. But it meant that I'd say there were rogue actors, not just in Syria, but who were willing to test us. And, it's very hard to prove this, but it did seem as though the kind of culture of impunity that exists internationally got a little bit of a boost from the sense that America was going to be on the sidelines necessarily, almost no matter what was done in Syria.
And what about what has not been done in Yemen? There are those who say, this was on Obama's watch, too. You could have done a lot more to, so the argument goes, avert the kind of humanitarian crisis we're in now.
I personally think that's very fair, a very fair criticism. I think what people forget now, understandably, is why U.S. involvement started in Yemen. You had a legitimate government. It was post-Arab Spring. They had a quasi-election in Yemen, the first that they'd had. And the sovereign government was elected. They weren't, killing their people as was happening across the region. And the Houthi backed to some extent, although also with backed to some extent by Iran, but also with a lot of indigenous support, basically steamrolled through the country and overran the legitimately elected government. That government came to the UN and said, we want support. The United States, in a modest way, said, okay, we'll support those who are going to help you try to regain power. But very quickly, so that was the sort of casus belli at the outset for providing the military support that the U.S. was providing. And you can, in the wake of the Iran deal, there was a lot of unease on the part of, traditional U.S. allies in the region, including Saudi Arabia. So the United States got involved in a support role. But at the point, which was very early, where it became clear just how indifferent the Saudi government was to the fate of the Yemeni people, when they started using blockades, when they couldn't shoot straight, to me, that was the time to pull the plug. And Trump has deepened involvement. It's much worse now. His support, his unconditional support for the Saudis, no matter what they do, no matter which dissidents they chop up in which diplomatic facilities around the world. I mean, there's nothing that Saudi Arabia can do that would cause Trump to revisit the relationship. But we should have pulled the plug far sooner.
One also has to ask the question how much of that may indeed be financial. There have been a lot of dealings with his son-in-law in Saudi Arabia. We're talking with Samantha Power, professor of global leadership and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School and professor of practice in human rights at Harvard Law School and former U.N. ambassador. Her new book is The Education of an Idealist. And when I saw that title, I thought often when idealists become educated, they become cynics.
Not this one. No, I know the title is a little misleading, but what I'm trying to show at a time when we obviously need profound changes in our society domestically, but also profound changes in our foreign policy, is it helps to get educated. It helps to learn what not to do, how to build coalitions, how to prioritize, how to dust yourself off when you fail. But it's really about how to learn how to prosecute your ideals in the world with more effectiveness. And so my hope is that young people especially don't have to go through all of my education. They can maybe read the book and spare themselves some of the hard-won lessons. But I'm especially having served in the Obama administration, I left much more upbeat, actually, about one person's ability to make a difference in their community or in the world. So, you're right. You never see the book that's like The Education of a Cynic, how I became more upbeat about my potential to make social change. But this is not a story of cynicism by any means.
Well, there's an underlying motif in your story, and it goes back really to your Pulitzer Prize-winning book about genocide, at least in my judgment, and it ties in with how much is appropriate for power to be exercised when it comes to not only intervening in a humanitarian crisis, but intervening in something that seems to be filled with the possibility of genocide, or filled certainly with people being killed and being massacred and being mutilated for reasons that have to do more with despotism than with anything else. That question continues to loom. I mean, it looms over, obviously, your work as not only a journalist, a war correspondent, but also as your work in diplomacy.
Yeah, I mean, I tell the story of meeting Barack Obama back in 2005, just after he was elected to the Senate, and he sort of swept into office, and he was only the 99th senator, but had this platform, and he reached out to me, and yes, he had read A Problem from Hell and was interested in the sort of relatively narrow question of how the United States could do better in the face of mass atrocities, but he was also interested in why we invaded Iraq and how we could have invaded Iraq without having done proper planning. He, of course, had opposed the war. I had opposed the war. And he saw sort of Rwanda and the non-response, or the decision to pull peacekeepers out of Rwanda while a million people were killed, and the decision to invade Iraq and all the wreckage, human and strategic wreckage that ensued, as kind of the flip sides of the same coin, the systematic failure to think through human consequences in decision-making. And so, you know, when I had the privilege of being his human rights advisor, yes, it's true, we had to figure out how to respond to atrocities in South Sudan or in Darfur or in Cote d'Ivoire, and that was a part of my portfolio, but it was also how do we promote LGBT rights? A military unit, who is part of an ally's military, comes to us and wants military assistance. How do you balance the strategic relationship, as some people define it, with the fact that this is a tainted unit that has been involved in human rights abuses? My view is, you don't provide assistance,
and so in the UN, you went after Russia in terms of they're trying to essentially separate same-sex rules when it came to, you know, actually doling out rights to that simply didn't exist for same-sex couples.
I mean that's an example, right, of the tools in our toolbox. I mean, one can talk about military intervention and when we should use it or when we should employ military force. That's a very, very narrow part, and hopefully a very rare thing that the United States should do. It should be far rarer, I think, than it's employed now. But we have this toolbox, and when I got to the UN, I noted that same-sex couples who worked for the UN, whether in New York or anywhere around the world, were not entitled to the same benefits as their heterosexual counterparts. And again, a small piece of business relative to responding to a chemical weapons attack or responding to Putin's attempted annexation of Crimea, but really hard to get done when 79 countries in the UN criminalize same-sex acts and LGBT status. And of course, Russia, which was already militarizing its foreign policy and being more aggressive beyond its borders. But one of the things that dictators, and we see this also in our current president, but one of the things dictators and our current president, because they are different, he's not a dictator as such, but the tactics that they use is to demonize and to sometimes manufacture foreign enemies. And whether that's immigrants or migrants or the media, in our case here in our democracy, or in President Putin's case, it was LGBT people, where he created this idea that there was this Western imperial plot, and that and conflating being LGBT with pedophilia. I mean, just horrific propaganda and demonization. But he tried to bring that to the UN. And one of the tools in my toolbox was to say, no, actually, we're at a moment where LGBT people are being persecuted all around the world, sometimes killed just for who they are. And we're America, and we have a toolbox. And so first, let's start and see if we can get benefits for same-sex couples within the UN. Did that. And then Russia tried basically to roll that back in a story I tell in the book. But the other thing we did was we actually got the UN Security Council to condemn the people on the basis of their sexual orientation for the first time in the 70-plus year history of the UN over Russia's resistance and reluctance.
I think that was a wonderful accomplishment. But of course, you know, you've been criticized for putting emphasis on that rather than on, well, drone strikes or things that the American government was involved in, and, you know, taking people to secret places and putting them through torture and interrogation and no punishment with that. How do you set priorities, I guess, becomes a question, especially when you're a UN ambassador.
Sure. Well, let me just correct the premise, because certainly under President Obama, we weren't taking people to secret places to torture them and so forth. I think that the criticism, which is very fair and was something that I think President Obama will speak to in his book when it comes out, but is, you know, how much do you punish and hold accountable people who've been involved in those practices in the prior administration? And I would have leaned farther in that direction, because I think when we go abroad and tell other countries to hold accountable their torturers, we need to do the same. I think it makes it much more likely that torture will recur when you don't. President Obama is looking at trying to bring the country together in the face of the largest economic recession since the Great Depression, and thought that doing so would really drive a further wedge in our already polarized country. So not everything that comes out of the Obama administration were policies that I supported, but what I tried to show in the book is that even when you lose, and that happens from time to time for anybody, especially who's trying to bring a human rights agenda to the White House, even with a president as enlightened and as humane as President Obama was, there are other battles you can fight. And so I think, you know, the fact that I didn't mention every human rights crisis that unfolded in the White House is a little bit unfair. I mean, fundamentally, I'm trying to show illustratively also in as gripping a way as I can to try to get people to engage again on American leadership and on internationalism. And, you know, it's already a long enough book. I didn't want to inflict everything, but I do try to show the cases where I think we go wrong, because part of getting educated as an idealist is also being prepared to be self-critical and to look back and see if we can harness these lessons now, hopefully for the next Democratic president.
There is a lot in the book, and the book, again, is called The Education of an Idealist. It's also a very personal book in many ways. It talks about Samantha Power coming here as a young Irish immigrant and her family, and not only the family that she biologically was born into, but also the family that she created. And there were fertility problems, and there were miscarriages, and there's a lot in here that she poured of herself. We're going to continue talking with her, and we're going to certainly welcome your involvement in the program. In fact, let me invite you to join us. You can join us at our toll-free number, and the number to call is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786, and again, that's toll-free. You can also join us by getting in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, and you can email us any questions you might have for the ambassador or comments you might have, forum@kqed.org. But the toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. And we will continue with Samantha Power and with you. In fact, maybe when we return, I'll ask her why, under all that pressure and all her idealism, she didn't do what Ambassador Robert Ford did. She goes into the struggle in the book and resigned. More when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Samantha Power, who is professor of global leadership and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School and professor of practice in human rights at Harvard Law School and former UN ambassador. Her new book is called The Education of an Idealist, and you can join us here in conversation. We invite you to do that. Toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Your Samantha Power colleague, Paul Farmer, was on with us recently, and they've made some extraordinary advances now with fighting Ebola. But you began the mobilization, and I want to talk about that briefly with you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, people ask me, you know, what are you most proud of in the time, or they ask me, what are you most ashamed of as well? But But I, being a part of the Ebola response and seeing President Obama really buck bipartisan opposition, or at least bipartisan fear and panic in this country, in deploying, in fact, our military along with more than 1,000 American health workers into the eye of the storm, the eye of the epidemic, at a time when people anticipated, epidemiologists anticipated, that 1.4 million people would be infected within a matter of months, and then being empowered as the U.S. ambassador. I mean, I just can't tell you what it feels like when America leads and when you're empowered to go and try to build a global coalition along with Secretary Kerry and others in the administration. And then I can go to China and say, look, here's what we're doing. Here's how many Ebola treatment units we're building. What are you going to do? You want to be, you know, at the head table? You want to be part of a P2 with the United States? What are you going to contribute? To go to the United Kingdom and say, okay, we're going to take the leadership role in Liberia. You know, you do Sierra Leone. You have a history there and know that country. And to go even to Cuba and to say, hey, you got doctors who work in sub-Saharan Africa and have for a long time, and Cuba ended up contributing more doctors per capita than any other country. But I dwell on it not because we can ever imagine President Trump doing anything similar anytime soon, but there is a way these days where U.S. leadership is kind of because the wars have been so draining in Iraq and Afghanistan on such a narrow segment of our society, but people have borne such burdens, there is such fatigue with that, that I think sometimes people forget the catalytic positive role that the United States can play on issues that can generate broader consensus. But the other thing about Ebola that I show in the book is how Trump, you know, then really just a reality TV star and or as such, and a real estate guy and a businessman. But that was the first time he really capitalized on the fear-mongering to try to draw attention to himself. I mean, he was on Fox pretty much every day talking about how Obama was bringing Ebola to America's shores and scaring people. And I think what he saw was that drew more attention to himself, and that approach of the fear-mongering, which he'd always, of course, you know, back.
Went from Ebola to migrants, basically.
He did. And then he went to immigration. And then suddenly it was actually that, you know, Syrian refugees coming into the country were ISIS agents who carried Ebola. I mean, some of the claims just got completely absurd. Yet if you look at the level of fear, you know, among Democratic voters and Republican voters, it really spiked in this period. And you need leadership that can discipline itself to not be guided by fear, which is what I'm really proud that Obama managed in that period.
We've got a lot of people who want to talk with you, and I want to go to calls, but I promised before the break that I would ask you about not resigning. And you take it up in your book, and you also take up the fact that you feel you kind of lost your innocence when you were being queried by Senator Rubio about various things where the United States was concerned and your points of view. And I believe your response was to say that you thought this was a great country, or words to that effect, patriotic kind of rhetoric. Let's talk just for a moment about why you didn't resign, especially over Syria, because as I said, Ambassador Ford did, and you talk about, you know, feeling maybe you should have. What was the key?
Well, I don't think I should have. I mean, I have thought a lot about it. I felt, having written in A Problem from Hell about people who resigned over, for example, you know, the failure to respond quickly and robustly to what was happening in Bosnia, to the concentration camps and so forth, I kind of valorized those acts of resignation, that when people, including the Wall Street Journal editorial board and Washington Post editorial writers and John McCain, for that matter, started calling for my resignation, I tried, you know,
Did John McCain really hang up on you?
He hung up on me. He did. Okay. I'm sure not a unique privilege that I had, but he did. A story I tell in the book. But I think, you know, I had a responsibility to try to distance myself from what I was doing every day and ask, you know, is this, you know, am I becoming one of the people that I wrote about, which I, of course, was not on my to-do list.
And that was the struggle, though, really, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I was a member of the president's cabinet. You know, at the same time that Syria was happening, and, you know, it was the most heartbreaking and the most strategically damaging thing, I think, that happened on our watch, on the one hand. But at the same time, I was helping lead the response to the Ebola epidemic. At the same time, I was trying to get the Paris Agreement on climate change across the finish line so that it would have the force of international law before the November 2016 election, so that if a Republican, or if in fact Donald Trump won, he would, yes, be able, unfortunately, to pull out of the Paris Agreement for the United States, but he couldn't unravel the entire agreement. you know, there were mass atrocities happening in large parts of sub-Saharan Africa. There's Boko Haram. There were so many things that I could use my position to do. I think the key for me was to be intentional, and you know, you can kind of drift along. I write in the book about something that Jim Thompson wrote about during the Vietnam War, which is the effectiveness trap, you know, that you can rationalize whether you're in business where bad things are, you know, sort of corrupt things are happening, or any organization where you look around and you see something that doesn't sit right with you, you can rationalize and say, well, I'm going to live to fight another day, and, you know, I can work on this even if I'm failing on that. And so, you know, when I found myself, in effect, making that argument to myself, I thought, am I falling into the effectiveness trap? But I think, you know, when I look across the list of foreign policy, progressive, reformist, things that we were able to achieve, when I look at the coalitions that we built, you know, again, whether on climate or on fighting ISIS and trying to ensure that we did so and abided by international humanitarian law as we did so, I just thought I was doing an awful lot more good, maybe not enough good, all things considered, but an awful lot more good staying within the administration and serving President Obama. And the last thing I'd say is I also, even though I believed that we shouldn't have told the world we were going to take limited military action after the chemical weapons attack and then pull back from that, I did have that belief. At the same time, at no point did I think President Obama wasn't listening to me. You know, that I was just there as some sort of cosmetic, you know, person who had credibility or had had credibility on atrocity prevention. At no point did I think that his judgment was motivated by anything other than what was best for the country. And you know, as we talked about earlier, he was looking, you know, at a different set of considerations than I was. He was still trying to pull the country out of great economic pain, right? I was meeting with members of the White Helmets who were being bombarded by Russia or by the Syrian government. You know, inevitably our perspectives were different, and I could see if I was in his shoes, having made the same decision, even as I urged him to go in the different direction. So it wasn't as if there was any bad faith or any self-aggrandizement in his decision making or anything like what we see today. And it was such an opportunity to try to bring a human rights agenda to the highest level of government in a way that is really quite rare in our history.
I want to go to our callers, and let's begin with you, James. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. I was going to ask a two-part question, but you answered one of them regarding what actions or things that you did during the red line, you know, crossing the red line in Syria. But the other part question is, relative to the President Obama's decisions being what's in the best interest of the country, how do you juxtapose that with the targeting of the underage boy in the outdoor American citizen too, being targeted by a drone bombing? I think his father was somebody they were after, the Alaki, but they specifically targeted an American citizen, a boy. How do you juxtapose that with your work and with what you did after that? The comment offline.
Yeah. All right, thank you for the call.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fair question. I think, you know, what President Obama was balancing in that case, along with others, and not certainly not the killing of the boy, but in targeting Alaki, was the intelligence that he was receiving about the threats to Americans posed by Alaki. And I wasn't involved in those debates. It was before I was a member of the cabinet. But
Alaki was an American citizen, though.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So I wasn't part of those deliberations. I'm not, I was part of the administration. But my understanding is that as he's looking at issues of legality and legitimacy, humanity, he's also looking at the lives of Americans. And so fundamentally, he made that call. And, you know, publicly at the time, I think articulated why he thought it was justified legally. Having said that, you know, part of what happens when you take strikes from far away is you increase by a very substantial amount the risk that you're also going to target civilians who are not implicated in the threats that you're trying to neutralize. And on those issues, President Obama, I know the drone program is controversial because, in effect, we're judge, jury, and executioner. The United States takes on that role And again, without a lot of domestic debate either, often in the shadows, you know, carried out without the kind of transparency I think you need in a democracy. But, you know, at a time when those threats are real and he's the commander in chief and he's trying to keep our embassies safe and our diplomats safe, and at a time when nobody is enthusiastic about deploying our military on the ground, you know, he has justified that program on the grounds that, all things considered, again, it enhances U.S. security.
It's also a heartbreaking story in your book about a child killed by the auto that you were driving in Nigeria.
Not that I was driving.
That was being driven with, actually, I think there were, what, about seven armored, because you were going there because Boko Haram had kidnapped all those young women and taken them hostage. Just also inclined to, well, let me get another caller on. I got a lot of people who want to speak with you. We'll get to as many as we can. We get Stephen next. Stephen, join us.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Samantha. You know, I had a question. I know that you opposed the invasion of Iraq. I don't recall your position on the invasion of Afghanistan. I always thought that, you know, it should have been treated as the heinous criminal conspiracy that it was, and charged as a conspiracy in an Article III district court. And I think that had we interrupted that conspiracy before the planes flew into the Twin Towers, they would have been prosecuted in federal court, just like the 1993 bombing. And I'm just wondering what...
Who is they that you're talking about? Who is going to be prosecuted? I'm unclear.
I think that had all the people who died, not all the people, but the criminal people who were responsible for 9/11, had that conspiracy been interrupted?
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because this was not what you said you wanted to speak about, and I don't know what criminal conspiracy on 9/11 actually implies, although there's certainly been a lot of guessing about the Saudi role in 9/11, or at least perhaps all the Wahhabism that had to do with being a catalyst for 9/11, and I think that has to be evaluated now when we're talking about going to bat for the Saudis because they were hit by Iran. Would you agree?
I would, and I mean, I found personally very offensive their reference to the potentially the Iran, what are it looks like Iranian attacks on their oil infrastructure, but referring to that as the Saudis 9/11, which was, I thought, was in very bad taste for Saudi officials to be referring to it that way, given that so many of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, and given, again, the sort of wink-wink that the Saudi regime for so long did in terms of the radicalization and the networking and the terrorist financing within their midst. If I may just pick up on, I guess, one dimension of what I think the caller might have been getting at, and I wasn't clear, but, you know, on this question of can you pursue terrorists, like per our discussion that we just had about the drone program, can you pursue them using the rule of law, at, you know, using less dangerous means, you know, can you get them into courts of law? We went through this when it came to trying to close Guantanamo Bay, you know, another one of the really frustrating dimensions of the 8 years that President Obama was in power. Yes, we brought the prisoner population way down and repatriated a number of the inmates, but Congress tied our hands and wouldn't allow us to bring you know, many of the leading suspects into the United States, basically said that no American dollars could be used for the purposes of holding inmates who were in this black hole of Guantanamo Bay in maximum security prisons. Today, there was a New York Times piece this week on how I think it's, you know, the per inmate cost of holding them in Guantanamo Bay is more than $10 million, I think, because the population has now shrunk down to just 40 inmates. But, you put your finger, I think, on the politics surrounding pursuing legal prosecution, which should not be as polarized as they are, because we have the capacity through our courts, as you know, through criminal conspiracy laws, through laws of all kinds, to put away people who are conspiring against us, to put away terrorists, you know, in some cases for the rest of their lives. And the challenge is that many of the people plotting are not in the United States. And so you still get to that question of how can you gain custody of those individuals? How do you amass the evidentiary body or the body of evidence that you would need in order to pursue criminal proceedings? But I'm completely with you.
In fact, we have a lot of Russians who were indicted under the Mueller investigation who are never going to see a day in an American courtroom.
Well, there's that, exactly. When especially when your suspects are in countries that will refuse to extradite, which is often the case, I mean, given that these terrorists tend to hang out in places that aren't always friendly to the United States. So as an aspiration and as something that we should be able to come together on is just that we can trust our justice system to enhance our national security. But there are, again, these other impediments in the way that one has to take into account.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. Rob, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a couple of sort of naive questions, or at least on the surface. The first of all is, why would Iran make such a provocative attack against the Saudi Arabian oil facilities when, you know, it just seems like they're poking the bear and creating a huge international incident?
Sorry, Rob, you think about bears as Russia. Russia does not play a role in this, but...
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to...
No, but they could have been poking Saudi Arabia as well as the United States. I would certainly grant you that.
Oh, sorry. Right. And the other question is, so what if we just left the Middle East? We've sent arms to Saudi Arabia, we've sent arms to Israel, we've sent arms all over the place for them to defend themselves. Why do we keep having to spend more of our own money, lose our own people over in the Middle East when it seems like no matter what we do, it's the wrong thing? They're going to hate us no matter what. What if we just packed up our lunch and left?
That's a fair question, and I'd like to hear what Ambassador Power has to say. I was also just reading someone who was opining that all of the intervening we did in the Middle East, the only place we didn't intervene or try to get involved in was Tunisia, which is probably the only place that has established a kind of secular or quasi-secular democracy. But Ambassador, let me go to you on this.
So, in terms of your first question, I mean, again, I haven't seen the intelligence to know how credible it is that Iran was behind it. It certainly is a very provocative and risky act. But it's alongside other provocative acts, right? The seizure of ships, the closing off of sea lanes. I mean, I know it's not the same as hitting an oil refinery and causing global oil prices to go up by 10% overnight. But I myself cannot put myself, nor should I think, in the shoes of the Iranian regime. But I think if they are responsible, it shows you also something about how they are processing what they perceive to be our escalatory acts, right? Of, you know, they perceive themselves to have complied with a set of very stringent, very invasive terms, to be letting a bunch of international inspectors running around their nuclear facilities.
And they are complying,
they were complying.
With the treaty. They were.
But in the face of then seeing virtually all of the sanctions that the United States had lifted reimposed, in the face of seeing the United States then imposing secondary sanctions on even and threatening to do so even against, our closest European allies, they view that as very escalatory and very confrontational, and they view what the Saudis are doing in Yemen and what the Saudis are doing elsewhere as well as confrontational in that manner. So I think there's a context here that maybe speaks to your question if, in fact, they were responsible, as does seem likely. Regarding your second question, certainly when it comes to the use of military force in the Middle East, whether that's in Iraq or any place else, it has not proven, as it were, beneficial to our national security, to the interests of our people, and it's an extremely complex set of dynamics. Depending, whatever country you're talking about, I also think the military assistance that we've provided to Egypt, for example, which we dial back in the wake of a massacre carried out by the successors to President Morsi, you know, when they basically mowed down and murdered, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Egyptians who were just peacefully protesting. But then the national security establishment, you know, just pushes to re-up that because there is this desire to have allies in the region. I think we're way too permissive in terms of, you know, how forgiving we are of the practices, as I said earlier in the show, the practices of these militaries. And there's no, there should be no blank check and no entitlement to U.S. military assistance. But having said that, just to introduce one note of caution, because the premise of your question, I think, is has inherent appeal, but is, you know, President Obama did get us out of Iraq, did finally pull our troops home, did finally allow people who are on their fourth and fifth tours, you know, to stop having to go back to Iraq. And in part because of the damage done by the original invasion and the destruction of institutions, but also because of there are radicals and extremists who are out there. But ISIS, of course, did develop a foothold, and we ended up having to go back in order to prevent that caliphate from expanding indefinitely. And so what we really want is the national and the indigenous governments to be able to protect their own citizens and to not require, again, U.S. help to prevent a terrorist state from existing anywhere in the world.
We're talking with Samantha Powers, and she'll be appearing 7 p.m. this evening in Santa Cruz. More information at bookshopsantacruz.com. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let me go to another question, if I may, with you, Samantha Power, and that is just, is there kind of a notion of how helpful it is, and I think the Trump administration presents this, to just talk? I mean, talk to Kim Jong-un, we'll talk to, you know, the Taliban, we'll meet with them at Camp David, we'll talk to Rouhani. I mean, that's pretty much been consistent from this administration, and hasn't necessarily borne a great deal of results, but nevertheless, in many people's minds, this is how you do diplomacy. You talk.
I'm pro-talk. Let me put my cards on the table, and, you know, the old saying, jaw, jaw, jaw is better than war, war, war. President Obama was ridiculed, of course, by his political opponents. First in the election campaign itself, when he said he was willing to engage adversarial regimes, and then when we actually went and did it in Cuba, in Iran, in Burma. But it's essential. But what you can't do is expect, you know, that the spectacle of a photo op is going to produce what the painstaking years of diplomacy that preceded the Iran deal would produce. I mean, just showing up and thinking, you know, that you can erase the complexity. I mean, any of the regimes we would most want to talk to, we have such difficult history with by definition. And within those countries, the whether it's sectarian dynamics in the Middle East or, you know, the kinds of dynamics that you see within the state of North Korea after years of being a weapon of mass destruction toward the North Korean people, as well as pursuing weapons of mass destruction. I mean, these are really complicated regimes to be dealing with. And so the idea that you swoop in, you tweet your way to actually being able to achieve something on behalf of the American people and our interests is just arrogant in the extreme, but also foolhardy. And to show up at that level with regimes that are craving international recognition gives up something without getting anything in return. But you know, one of the stories I tell in my book, The Education of an Idealist, is when I became U.S. ambassador, I decided to go around and meet with 191 of the other ambassadors at the U.N., which is, by the way, not that big a deal because I didn't have to leave the island of Manhattan to be able to have these conversations and to engage all of these countries that were represented every day in the U.N. And around 50 of the ambassadors that I visited, you know, mainly from small countries or countries that we don't have very warm ties, you know, but about 50 of them had never been visited by a U.S. permanent representative. And, you know, that's how often the United States sort of strides forth in the world. And yet some of these countries are countries like island countries that are literally disappearing into the sea because of the long lag in U.S. leadership, you know, on climate, or at least because of all of, you know, the major emitters unwillingness to do what it takes to get our emissions under control. And you know, what you learn also by talking to small countries, by putting yourself in the shoes of countries that you know aren't on the news, and the problems that they face, and how much more stable our world would be if just with modest investments, you know, whether Peace Corps volunteers or of diplomacy, we could make a profound difference. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in the book, again, is to open up. The world is not only about wars in the Middle East, right? And by fighting these wars in the Middle East, as the previous caller indicated, we end up hemorrhaging resources that we could deploy in service of a more just and stable world, which of course is one that would ultimately redound to the benefit of Americans.
Again, Samantha Power's new book is called The Education of an Idealist. We've got just a little bit left here to wrap this up. Are you thinking about getting into public life again, leaving the academy, running for office for that matter?
Right now I'm thinking about the skepticism people have about U.S. leadership in the world. And one of the reasons I wrote a book that describes my own vulnerabilities and my own journey as an immigrant and from a pub in Dublin to somehow being in the cabinet, but is to try to tell a story that young people in particular, but anybody young of heart can relate to, in order to try to, again, expand the constituency of people who are activated to take back our country, because that's what we need above all.
Good luck in that idealistic mission of yours, and thank you so much for joining us. The book, again, a memoir by Samantha Powers called The Education of an Idealist, and she'll be at Santa Cruz this evening at 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. Thank you for joining us for these 2 hours, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and we'll be back with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.